Hello, welcome to another edition of 108 Harley Street. I'm your host, Stel, and I have plenty of co-hosts with me on this edition, but the one gentleman I'm going to introduce first is clinical director of a Harley Street physio. It's Benoit Matthew. Benoit, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Yeah. Hi, thanks for having me. It's a real honor to join you guys. You're doing a lot of great work with hip and groin patients, so love to catch up with you.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again for joining us. Before we get cracking, so to speak, tell us a little bit about yourself, because I understand you studied at the University of Hertfordshire, is that right?
Yeah, so yeah.
Which campus?
It was the main one, you know, it's the main campus. Uh-huh. It's a while ago, it's sort of 6-7 years ago. So,
wow, it's not a while ago, come on.
So yeah, so I'm a physio by trade, so I do, you know, a few random things. So basically I do like 2 days with the NHS, I do a bit of central London private practice prominently. I would say 99% it's hip and groin or running. I specialize in lower limb, mostly hips and knees. Big into shockwave, so I do a bit of teaching on that. Also into ultrasound. So I think predominantly it's mostly lower limb, combining a bit of NHS and private practice, mostly recreational runners. I'm also involved in teaching. So I teach a hip and groin course, which I've been teaching for the last 7-8 years. So I like the variety and also keeping it real with the patients. So, you know, for me, it's important that, you know, I remain as a, you know, full-time clinician, because then it brings that reality when I teach and when I do the sort of shows.
Mm, fantastic. And you're based at the Mayfair Hotel, is that right?
Yeah.
What's the clientele like there?
Yeah, I think most, I would say, is 95% plus would be your weekend warrior type, the bankers, so sort of late, you know, early 30s, 40s, who have been active before in their life. So they've played a lot of rugby or football when they're young, went to the city, got active, and then they're getting problems. And then I do see a few dancers, because I tend to attract the hip and groin. So I would say my clientele is 70% more female. So
okay.
I specialize more in hip dysplasia, which I tend to see more with the dancers and the runners. Obviously, I do see the occasional adductors and the young males, but my practice is more females. I don't know how that happened, but it's sort of that's sort of, you know, I guess I treated some yoga teachers and initially, so it sort of spread the word, and I'm more familiar in that group. So with, you know, it's a huge area, hip and groin, and we can all have different facets of it. You know, sometimes you're dealing with a young male population, or you're treating the weekend warrior. So mine is more the recreational type, you know, the yoga teachers, Pilates teachers, the runners, and the weekend warriors. So that sort of mix. So I used to deal long back with professional sports, but I would say all my patients now are recreational athletes.
Fantastic. I'm going to hand you over to Johnny Wilson, who's my expert co-host. Mr. Wilson?
Do you know what? You've caught me in the middle of trying to get out of a wetsuit. I'm actually full head to toe in a wetsuit right now, trying on the new O'Neill Hyper Freak, fortunately. Oh, yes. And it fits like butter. You know,
I don't want to lower the tone, right? But I don't want to imagine what I caught you in the middle of, honestly.
Well, you know, it looks fine. Okay. Looks nice. But anyway, we can have this conversation afterwards. Anyway.
We always do, John. We always do.
Moving onwards from our wetsuit review, by the way, it keeps you warm, toasty, and also is very, very flexible, is the O'Neill Hyper Freak 4-3. Anyway, moving forwards. Benoit, absolute pleasure to have you on the show. It's been one of our targets. We have a 12-month target as a group here, and we have identified those people who have given a huge amount with regards to their time and their expertise and sharing their knowledge and, you know, helping other people with regards to management of hip and groin pain. And you are certainly one of the leading lights in that. So along with the rest of the guys here, certainly follow you on social media. I recently, with Paulina, attended one of your webinars. In fact, I couldn't get onto it, so I had to watch it through WhatsApp on Paulina's laptop. That's how that's how popular it was. It was a brilliant series, actually. So it was.
Thank you.
I take my hat off to you on that, and was free, which was always lovely to benefit from that. So tonight, right, we've got our fantastic panel from 108 Harley Street, and our clinicians are based in Iceland, out in Australia, from Poland, Ireland, and now we've got an Indian on the phone tonight. So this will be. This would be good, won't it, with all these different accents.
But yeah.
The focus of tonight, Benoy, is all about the subjective.
Of course, yeah.
So we're not going to talk about anything else. It's like about how do you get good at the subjective part of the hip and groin? How do you become an expert in this? How do you take out the questions that are around, you know, the importance of the subjective? Because in my experience, and when I was a younger physio, you know, it was all about, I remember putting together Excel sheets and all the tests that you had to do for this and to do for that. And really, for me, the shift in my practice came was when I did a master's in sport and exercise medicine. Oh, no, it was my other master's in physiotherapy. And it was about the subjective, and it was a real paradigm shift for me about 10 years ago, maybe a little bit longer than that. So, that's what tonight's show is about. So for all the listeners who are out there, for clinicians or athletes or anything like that, if you're struggling with hip and groin pain and you want to know what forms the basis of a absolutely fantastic subjective, then this is the show for you tonight. So I'm going to keep my question till the end, Benoy, and I'm going to introduce my colleague, Paulina, and Paulina's going to kick off with some red flags, I think. Is that cool with you, Benoy?
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, because it's important to pick those up early.
Okay, well, let's listen. I like the podcasts that are fast moving, do a deep dive. Nobody's messing about. They get straight to the crunch, but then we can have chats afterwards.
Yeah.
So, Paulina, over to you.
Thank you, Johnny, and hello, Benoy. It's great having you on a podcast here tonight, like Johnny said before.
And watching your exercise for seniors, great idea, you know, so great job.
Perfect. Thank you very much for that. So I just thought I'm going to start with saying basically, well, as Johnny highlighted already, we've been watching one of your Function for Fitness webinars or Function 2 Fitness webinars series, and, well, specifically, you know, the one titled Hip and Groin, the Red Flags, because, you know, this is exactly what we're talking about here today.
Yeah.
So you know, what it fits perfectly. So, you know, so it's a great, great talk, and I really enjoyed it. And I found one of your acronyms that you used there very, very useful. So you had an SAM acronym there, which you maybe want to explain a little bit more to our listeners. So, you know, I thought that was very, very useful when thinking about the red flags specific to this region.
Yeah.
And I was just hoping that you can just tell our listeners more about that and what do we don't want to miss really in this early stages, and why recognizing it in the early stages is very essential as well.
Yeah. So thanks, Paulina. So I think red flags is a big passion of mine because unfortunately, we don't have any specific objective tests for this sort of area. And most people, you know, when I see them, they don't have an MRI. So we have to depend on the history for sussing it out. So just like if you, for example, if you're dealing with chronic low back pain, you don't want to miss cauda equina. It's sort of unjust if you can't just miss that. So the same thing you can apply for hip and groin. So in my opinion, there are three conditions where you can't afford to miss, and I'll explain you the reason why. So you know, I like to keep things simple so that I can remember. That's why I use the acronym SAM. So SAM stands for stress fracture, S for stress fracture, A for avascular necrosis, and M for metastasis. Usually they have a primary history of cancer or something. So first thing is, let's start with S, stress fracture. So that's something you're going to see, like, you know, normally I see 2-3 months before the London Marathon or whenever there's a spike. So the stress fracture of the hip is a little bit difficult. For example, if you have a stress fracture of the metatarsal, people will come and point you exactly where the pain is. So the runner comes in and say, my foot hurts, it's bang on there, on my fifth metatarsal, it hurts. you think like, okay, that could be a fracture. Whereas the hip, it's so deep, you can't palpate it with your hands. So most people, when they come with stress fracture, they generally give a very vague definition. In the early stage, when they have a stress reaction, they can still run through it. So the typical profile would be a female runner. So when we look in the literature, the biggest risk factor for a stress fracture is a previous stress fracture. So one of the things you don't want to miss with my hip and groin is two things: is have you had previous stress fracture? Have you had previous cancer? So now the mistake I did a few years ago was, just because somebody's young, like 35, 34, you sometimes you forget they get cancer. So I had one patient who came to me. He was 34 or 35 with groin pain. He had testicular cancer when he was 16 or 17 or that quite young. And he had surgery, got better. But he didn't really, maybe I didn't ask enough. He didn't tell me enough. And then we scanned him later, and then he had a lot of metastasis, which recurred from his testicular cancer. So even if you're dealing with young people, you have to remember that sometimes they can get childhood cancers and other things, especially with the men, testicular cancer, which can recur. So the things you don't want to miss is previous stress fractures and previous cancer, because these are very powerful indicators. You're more likely to get stress fracture if you had it before. So when you deal with stress fracture, the female, if I get a female patient with groin pain, a runner, I'm always wary, because runners usually don't get groin pain. It's sort of not the common injury. They usually get like glute med, knee pain and things like that. So the female, you want to ask like, have you had previous stress fractures? Generally having a BMI less than 19. So if you're not eating well and you're too skinny and you're running 7 days a week, and you're coming with a vague groin pain, that might raise a suspicion that you might get a stress reaction. So there are two objective tests, although this is a subjective thing, might be useful to know, is I'll do like a hop test to see whether they can tolerate it. And there's also a good test. If you Google, you can find it. It's called the Fulcrum test. It's got decent reliability and specificity. So this is a simple test you can do in a clinic. And if they're positive, then you might send for an MRI. So that's a stress fracture. So usually female runners in a spike in volume, vague groin pain, they might get like an anterior thigh pain. A lot of them get diagnosed as RECFEM injuries, but it's not RECFEM. It's usually come as a thigh pain. So it's always keeping that suspicion in a female runner that could be one factor. The second one, which I, something which I know quite well personally, because, you know, one of my best friend had the condition avascular necrosis. So this is a weird condition, because if you look at the literature, avascular necrosis usually happens secondary to steroids, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, and if you're dealing with a, you know, Black Caribbean sickle cell anemia. So usual presentation is generally a male, late 20s or early 30s. And the sad thing is up to 50 to 60% of them don't have any risk factors. So if you get a male patient, you know, in the late 20s or early 30s, whose symptoms are getting worse and it doesn't make sense, I send them for an MRI purely to rule out avascular necrosis. So avascular necrosis is majority of the MOTC is idiopathic, which means like it just comes randomly in young men and we don't understand the condition. So the most of the cases I see is idiopathic. They're not taking alcohol, abusing it. Obviously, I believe them. They're not taking any drugs as far as I know. Just one of those random conditions which comes in those unlucky few. So it can come to anyone. Generally, it doesn't come spontaneously as you get older. So if you're dealing with an active male, you're doing the best rehab you can do, but things are not improving. Things are slowly getting better, you know, getting worse, and they're getting night pain, and things don't make sense. So just to make sure that you're not missing anything. So when I send them for an MRI, I tell them, the MRI is not to really make a diagnosis. It's mainly to rule out any nasties. So just make sure that everything is clear. So it's one of those things which can happen in young men. And studies have shown it's slightly more common in Asians and Africans. So that's slightly more. So the majority of your patients will be young men. So that's something you usually see in late 20s and 30s. And the classical history is, drug abuse or alcohol abuse, or if you're Black, sickle cell anemia. So that's the avascular necrosis. So if not picked up early, there are a few surgeries like core decompression. If you pick up early, that can save the femur. If it's too late, invariably in 10, 15 years, they'll end up with a hip replacement. And that could be career ending in many people. So if you pick them too late, then you sort of miss the boat for possibly surgery and other options. So aortocolectomy is something which should be in the back of the mind. And third, I've already touched briefly, is metastasis, is because of primary cancer. So they had cancer before, you know, they had some, you know, breast cancer, prostate cancer. Now, why is that important? So if you look at metastasis, so when you have a primary cancer and you get like a secondary areas in the bone, the most common location, the number one location is thoracic spine. The second most common location is the hip. So if you're getting metastasis next to the spine, thoracic spine, the second most common area is the hip joint, around the hip joint. So that's an area. So if you got somebody, so suppose you got like a 48-year-old lady, you know, coming in with hip and groin pain, and she said, I had breast cancer 6 years ago, but my hip is getting worse. So the NICE guidelines is very clear. If you get an unexplained back or hip pain with a previous history of cancer, the NICE guidelines say very clearly that you must get an MRI to rule out secondary metastasis. So those sort of things. So, you know, I don't want to panic people and say, fortunately, all these red flags are very less. So maybe if you're seeing 100 patients, maybe you might only see two or three, but they do occur and they're out there. So in my opinion, what are the most common things you're going to see in the red flags? Definitely stress fracture and stress reaction. They are the most common than avascular necrosis, especially with runners and track and field athletes. So stress fractures are more common. Avascular necrosis, you're going to see that more if you're dealing with young men. If you're dealing with a lot of men population, then you're going to see that. And metastasis, maybe not so much. You don't really get so much cancer around that region on that. So those are the three things, Sam. Stress fracture, avascular necrosis, and metastasis. So you should have a simple... So in my form, when I do my screening, so I can share what I do with my patients. So I have a little box for red flags. So what I tend to do is put the SAM on the side, and then avascular necrosis, I put like question, steroids, drug abuse, sickle cell anemia. For stress fractures, I'll put low BMI, white female, you know, unable to train. With metastasis, I'll put history of cancer, weight loss, and lethargy. So I think the key thing here is something where I might want to share with a novice physio is people think I remember everything. It's impossible for you to remember everything. I'm a big believer of checklist. So, you know, I hardly remember anything. I have checklists for everything. So if I get a hip patient, I have a checklist. If I have a knee patient, I have a checklist. So I have this sort of simple, because I don't trust my own memory on, I don't want to miss anything. So it's having systems. So I think the more you get experience, you try to have better systems in place so that you don't miss anything. So I work on systems, and you can create your own systems so that you're not sort of making any errors, because, you know, we are emotional creatures. You might have a good day, bad day, and you can forget things. So as long as you've got systems in place, you're less likely to make, you know, mistakes. And if things don't feel right, it's always getting help from your colleagues and working with a wider MDT. So I'm a big fan of working with, you know, fellow orthopedic surgeons, radiologists, sports doctors, you know, sports therapists, health and conditioning. So sometimes we don't have all the answers. So hopefully that covers the red flags. Is that okay, Paulina?
Yeah, that's great. Thank you very much. I love the insight and love, like, you know, having a checklist. That's definitely something that's a great advice, because I think that very often as you graduate and you think like, oh, I shouldn't rely on any kind of notes or support and anything like this. Well, you know what? Like, I would much rather have the checklist ready with me anytime I need it and not miss anything like it. So I think it's great. And, you know, the fact that you highlight this, I think is very important. And just linking to this first question, and some of this actually you have covered already. So still relating to this more sinister pathologies, you know, during your assessment or subjective assessment of the hip and groin specifically, what would be your key questions? So again, that kind of guidance on like to the clinicians, maybe starting clinicians who are listening, what would you feel, you know, the subjective needs to contain from the perspective of specifically questions? The type of questions that you would feel like you would not be happy with your subjective if you wouldn't ask them.
So I think a lot of, like, initially when I started my career a while ago, I just want to get on and do my special test. So, you know, you want to do the fancy, all the tests, you know, your squeeze test, you know, your quadrant test, you know, your Faber test. So they're all like fun, you know, funky, and you want to show to the patient that you know all these tests. But the reality is, I don't believe in special tests, but I believe in special questions. So in each area of the body, for example, there are special questions for low back pain. So I think there are special questions which I have a checklist. Again, So it's not, I've got the checklist right in front here, which I can share. So so I can share what are the special questions for hip and groin. So number one is something you don't want to miss is night pain, because night pain generally is not common in hip and groin unless they've got a flare up. So, I'm always concerned if somebody says I'm waking up every night, things like that. So that's number one. Number two is, which many patients will not tell you, is limping. So especially patients will not disclose you. A lot of patients limp when they're in pain. So something I ask is, do you limp during pain? The third question, special question would be, is do you have hip stiffness? So do you feel stiffness in the morning? Because a lot of patients with ankylosing spondylitis with men who have an underlying arthritic issues, their key symptom would be stiffness in the morning. So, if you're getting stiffness, is it arthritis, is it inflammatory condition? Because that's not normal for a 35-year-old or 40-year-old male or female to have stiffness. So that is, do you have hip stiffness? Fourth key point would be mechanical symptoms. So just like the knee, you ask clicking and catching. So I'll ask, do you have clicking, catching, or giving away with pain? A lot of people with snapping will have clicking, dances. But what I'm really asking them is, do you have clicking, catching, or giving away with pain? That's really relevant, because that can tell you that you have extensive label pathology, irritability, and things like that. So those patients, you might be a bit cautious on with your exercise, not to be aggressive with your stretches, because they could flare up. Next is a big one, which is usually missed, is childhood hip diseases. So really relevant for patients. So when you're young, did you have any hip problem? People won't tell you unless you ask them. So with a female patient, a lot of them will have dysplasia when they're young. They have splints, so they might forget that. And the male patient, they will forget they had prothese when they're young, so usually between the age of 4 to 8. Why is that important? Because if you had at that age, you're most likely... So let's imagine you've got prothese at the age of 4 or 5, and it was treated, you're more likely to come to physio in your 30s with early OA. So unless you know that they had prothese so young, you would miss that. So you would think it's impingement, but actually it's a simple osteoarthritis. And the reason they got it so young is because they had a childhood hip diseases. Most childhood hip diseases, even with treatment, invariably will lead to early arthritis. So you need to know that, whether they had a hip disease like prothese, Sophie's, and things like that. Family history, hugely important. So one of the things I ask with my patients is, did your family members, like your mother, father, and your siblings, have early hip replacement? So if a patient says, my mother had a hip replacement at 48, that makes me worried, because why did she have hip replacement at 40? And we know that hip osteoarthritis, there's a genetic link, mostly strong in females. So I've treated 3 sisters in the same family with early osteoarthritis, and they, ended up having hip replacement. So family history of early osteoarthritis is really important. Two more things, special questions is really important. Tell me how active you were from the age of 8 to 18. And why is that important? Because we know that from the age of 8 to 18, that's where you start developing your CAM morphology. Suppose you've been somebody who's been playing 7 days a week, playing football 5 days, rugby, climbing, you're more likely to have the morphology of a CAM or pincer, because the loading you do when you're young reshapes your bone. So it's not something which you're born with most of the time, it's what you do. So if you got somebody who's been really extremely and highly active during your teenage years, most likely they'll have some morphological variation which could come as a symptom later. So one of the things I'll always ask is, tell me how active you were from the age of 8 to 18. And the last one not to miss, especially in female population, is hypermobility. So I'll ask them, have you been diagnosed with hypermobility, especially with dances, because we know that is a risk factor for hip and groin issue. So if you ask me the most important special questions, so these are the special questions. They are more important than any special test. So I'm a big fan of special questions rather than special tests for hip and groin.
Amazing. Thank you very much for sharing that. That's a great list and surely not to be missed. So these are my 2 questions for you, Benoy, and I'll hand you over to Steph. And I think she'll dig in a little bit deeper into this adolescent type patients that we may see.
Yeah.
Hi, Benoy. It's Stephanie Rozowski here, down from Australia. Thanks for joining us on this podcast.
Yeah.
This morning down under. I have a question following on from the red flags, a little bit more focused on more yellow and orange flags.
Yeah.
So, over your years in practice, how well do you feel yellow and orange flag questions have been covered or included within subjective assessments, and more specifically within more adolescent population? Do you feel like these are possibly missed, or do you feel like these patients may hide this information a little bit compared to any other age group?
Yeah, that's a great question, because one of the reasons I chose hip and groin was I wanted to get away from chronic pain, from low back pain. But I soon realized, like, they still have the same distress and psychological effect as with any condition. So the role of psychosocial involvement is massive. And especially from my experience, the biggest fear I see with patients is the fear of early hip replacement. So one of the questions I ask them is, what concerns you most about this condition? And invariably, most people will say, I'll end up with a hip replacement, or I have a labral tear. So this is the most common concerns people have. And that can really stop them from enabling, from rehabilitation. And many times I have to reassure them that they have a healthy hip. So I think the thing which I was quite bad initially is missing the psychosocial variables, especially men. Men are very, very difficult to, young men, in my experience, maybe I don't have the knack, they don't open up when I come them, you know, so they don't really tell that. They just say, it hurts. I only get pain when I football. That's it, two lines, you know, help me. It's very hard to dig in. But I found a way around it. What I tend to do now is routinely, all my patients, before they see me, I send them a questionnaire of their symptoms, and I also send them HAGOS, which has some psychological elements as well. So I sort of screen them where I've got this sort of idea before they come in, especially with male patients. So there's questions on psychological impact, there's question on distress, there's question on sleep. So it massively helps me. So that's why I got 1 hour with my patients. I think these patients, you need at least 1 hour. So I never see anyone without filling the questionnaires. If they don't fill up, I don't see them, because I don't want to dig in. So they fill up, they send me a general health questionnaire, they send me specific on hip outcome measures, they send me on HAGOS. It takes around 10-15 minutes, but that makes a big difference when they come and see you. So I've got this information already, and then I can go straight and say, okay, you mentioned this is the problem, you mentioned that. So those sort of screening tools are really useful. Nowadays, it's quite easy. You can just create a simple Google form where they can just do it online, send them either you or somebody in the clinic can send them before, a day before you go in. And I always check that before they come in as well. So and when we go in directly for screening the sort of psychological aspect, so one of the things I always do, initially I used to, my first question when I talked to people was, tell me about your hip joint or tell me about your groin pain. I think that was a bit of a mistake on my side, because you're just going straight to the pathology and you miss the general picture. So what I tend to do now here is, when, most, I would say 90% of patients will come and see me and be recommended by a different surgeon or a different physio. So I start with something as, okay, you've been recommended by Mr. Vikas Kanduja from Cambridge. How can I help you? I don't even ask them about the groin in any way. So that sometimes can give you a lot of ideas. So sometimes they'll say, I'm not sure why I'm here. I've been told by my surgeon to see you because you're an expert on this. So that's one way. The second thing is, some people think, I already know what I have. I think I've got hip impingement. I want to know whether you can help me with the surgery. There'll be other patients who will be saying, I've tried everything with physio. I don't know what you can do. So I think having this open questions rather than going straight to the hip and groin is always a good way to sort of set the scene. So I generally want to know that general overview of how that affects. And another key question would be is, nearly all my patients I see is have chronic symptoms. So suppose they had it for 7 years and they're seeing me now. One of the things I'll ask them is, okay, you had it for 7 years. What made you to see me now? That's a really important question for me, because what has changed for you to seek help now? So one they'll say is, before it was always hurting, but it used to never affect my game. Now it's affecting my game. I can't, I'm limping 2 days after I play football. Or, I'm having, one of the big things which is missed with hip and groin pain is pain during sex. It's a big problem, because 95% of women with hip and groin pain have pain during sex. It's not something which is really big. So a lot of female patients says, I'm having difficulty with having sex with my partner and it hurts, and I don't want to tell my partner on that. So you need to know what is the trigger which made them to seek help. Is it a personal trigger? Is it a psychological trigger? Or is it because of compulsion from other people? So that sort of gives you an idea of what made you seek help. And also the key thing would be is, how does that affect them on a daily basis? So how does your hip pain affect your life? So they'll tell me, yes, I can't put my shoes and socks in the morning. I can't play with my kids. you know, I shouldn't be, you know, as a 36-year-old, I should be playing with my kids, and that really affects me. And then the last, which I said before, is what concerns you most about this condition? So, you know, we need to know the fear. You know, if you don't address the fear element initially, even if you give them the best rehab, they're not going to engage. You have to address the fear. So, you know, so for example, if somebody says, I'm concerned that I'm going to have a hip replacement. So I give them an example, like somebody like Andy Murray or anything. The hip replacement is not, you know, end of the road. You can still play tennis. You can still, you know, do 5Ks, 10Ks. So even in the worst scenario, you won't be crippled. So a lot of people have the old view of hip replacement. They think that if I have a hip replacement, I can just cycle. It's not like that. My best friend, he's 39. He had a hip replacement post-ABN. And he's planning to get back to badminton and 10K running. So it's not like olden days, your grandma's hips, you know. So worst scenario, you can still do that. So that is hugely relief for patients that they can still play, they can still play with the kids, they can still cycle, they can still do. And most of the surgeons I work with will let their patients run with their hips because they work with, you know, the, you know, either ceramic or poly combination. So they're confident. So most of my patients, I get them back running, not necessarily to marathon, but at least to 5K or 10K. So a lot of things they can get back. So first thing is to know what concerns them the most, the fear element. And if you don't address them, they won't engage. You know, they won't put their heart and soul into your rehab. And it's not your fault because mentally they'll have the barrier. So my top tips would be here is two things would be is always screen them with a tool. So you've got a lot of free tools, Hagos, the Hip Outcome Score. Always see them, especially in the chronic case, once you know a bit of about them so that they get that sort of relationship. And the second thing is always start with the open questions. So where you know about the lifestyle, the sleep, rather than going straight into the groin and saying, why does your hip groin hurt? So it's having, looking at the person first and looking at their impact before you go into their physical aspect, which is generally the easy bit.
Brilliant. Thank you. That was very, very insightful, Benoy. I'll now pass on to Vali to continue with some more questions.
Yeah, hi. Thank you, Steph, and hello, Benoy.
Yeah.
I'm Vali, a sports physio in Iceland, working in a private clinic and with a Premier League football club in Iceland.
I'm coming to Iceland to teach hip and groin. I've been called by your association. I think I'm coming in November to do a two-day course in Reykjavik, you know, to your capital. So,
oh, that's great. Yeah, we have to catch up then.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really exciting to be a part of tonight's show and getting the chance to ask you some questions on subjective, as I think it's very important to do a thorough subjective examination. So my first question is, so as you fill out the body charts, it is important to get the location of the symptoms, but can you explain why it's important to get the information on severity, irritability, and nature of the symptoms? And also, if you do feel we need to link that info with aggravating factors to better plan our objective examination?
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a great question because I think the thing is, first thing I would say here is, when we talk about hip pain or groin pain, the general public have a different idea of hip pain. You know, they sometimes, most people have got hip pain. The first thing I'm going to ask them is, show me where the pain is, because everybody has a different idea where the hip is. So some people it's lateral hip pain, some people it's anterior, some people it's groin pain. So I think we need to be very, very clear what we're talking about. So the difficult part with hip and groin is it doesn't have a specific, you know, sort of presentation. So for example, like a lot of people in females, it could be lateral, in men, it could be groin. So the key thing I want to know is it more anterior hip? Is it more lateral hip? Are they getting any buttock pain? And another thing is, are you getting any pain below the knees? So generally, hip and groin pain generally should not radiate below the knees. Although there's an exception, glute med tendinopathy can happen, but generally you should not radiate and you're having any pins and needles or numbness, which doesn't happen. So I think we need to be very clear with the location. Another thing I tend to do is ask them to use a finger, like a, what I call the, you know, finger test is with the pointing of the finger, I'll ask them, with your finger, can you localize exactly where the pain is? So a tip here would be is if your symptoms are from the hip joint, either it's early OA or hip impingement or hip dysplasia, it's very rare they can pinpoint a location. They'll say, I can't tell you. It's sometimes in the front, sometimes on the side, sometimes in the groin. So a deep, vague, poorly localized pain generally means it's intra-articular. If a patient puts a finger on one point, for example, an adductor, or on the glute meat, then generally it's a muscular or muscle tendon issue, or proximal hamstring, for example. So, localized pain generally is muscle tendon. A deep, vague, non-localized pain generally means it's intra-articular. And a lot of things you have to remember is most pathologies of the hip will have at least back pain or a side pain. Generally, they'll have a combination. So no FIA patient is going to come with just FIA. They might have a bit of back pain or they'll have some adductor. So one of the things which can confuse junior physios is, I've mentioned this a lot on my courses, is like, for example, FIA will come with his friends. He can come with two or three problems. You'll never, very rarely, you'll see with just one problem. So you're anticipating a bit of back pain, a bit of SIJ pain, a bit of adductor tightness. So you always expect a combination of things. So that is quite normal. Obviously, your aggravating and easing factor is really important, for example. So there are simple ways you can use to assess the irritability. So the way systems are used in the clinic is quite simple. The first question, we're talking about hip articular pathology. We're not talking about adductors or glute med. We're talking about FIA or dysplasia or OA. So one of the things I'm really interested in is sitting pain. So one of the things I'll ask them is, how much can you sit without pain? So if a patient says, I can only sit for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, that makes me worry of high irritability, because normal human beings should sit for at least 1 hour without pain in the groin. So if a patient says, I can't sit, I can't drive, you know, I can't watch a movie, I can't watch Netflix for more than 10, 15 minutes. So that is a good indicator of irritability. The second sign of irritability is, of course, night pain. If somebody says, I'm waking up with night pain, that also makes you think of irritability. And the third signs of irritability is limping. So if somebody says, I limp, that means high irritability. So this is a really important way to screen, because that can highlight you on how much you should push. Maybe you might be less aggressive with your exercises. Maybe you won't be pushing them too hard in the manual therapy. Maybe you might start them on some pull work or some gentle activation till the irritability settles down. And in some cases, you might have to ask them to contact their GP for 3-4 weeks of anti-inflammatory to calm down the hips. So the worst thing you can do is push them with high irritability. So general signs of irritability are night pain, limping, poor sitting tolerance, and things like that. So those are the patients you need to really be cautious with, trying not to be aggressive. It's like dealing with an acute low back pain with sciatica. You don't push those patients till the symptoms are stable. The same thing applies here, is wait till the symptoms are a bit better. Sometimes it's 1 week. So a bit of anti-inflammatory, a bit of getting to the pool, some gentle, you know, band exercises, activation stuff, you know, just to get that sensitivity down. And then obviously you can load them heavy. So another thing you'll see is, just like any other part of the body, they'll have flare-ups. So you need to give all this patient, you need to give them a flare-up plan. So when they get a flare-up, they know exactly what to do. So they're not calling you up and they're panicking. So, you know, you need to tell them. It's very normal for patients with a chronic condition to have a flare-up. So this is your step. So again, I give them a clear checklist. I give them like a 5-point checklist and say, when you get a flare up, these are the 5 things you do. Just, you know, don't worry. If you just do these 5 things, it'll calm down within a week. So we need to give them tools so that they don't get worried and anxious. So getting flare ups, getting high pains is part of the recovery. As long as you give them clear education tools and you give them a checklist so that they know exactly this is going to happen. This is more important post-operatively. I've never treated a single patient following hip arthroscopy who never had a flare-up. It's very normal to have at least one flare-up, usually around the 3rd or 4th month. As long as you know what to give them advice, it's normal. So that's really important. So for me, the irritability, you have to pick it up very, very, very early, and also you'll have to pick up, you know, sort of. Give them like a checklist on how to manage in a flare-up as well. So that's your management skills, which is part of, is as important, if not more important than your rehab skills.
Yeah, thank you. That's great. I love the idea of having a flare-up plan, because you always get those patients coming in and panicking about the flare-ups. So
yeah.
It's good to
Just like knee OA or a back patient, we give them a flare-up plan. We should do the same with a hip patient as well. So, you know, because the flare-ups are common with any chronic pathology. So you tell them, okay, take anti-inflammatory for 3-5 days, do this exercise, reduce your walking. So common thing would be stopping walking too much upstairs, walking too much uphill. If it's a runner, I'll ask them to stop running uphill, you know, running on hills and doing a lot of speed work. So they're simple strategies which can have a big effect on their pain levels, and they can recover within a week or two, and then they can go back to your normal rehab plan, which you must have planned anyway. So you need to always anticipate a flare-up. It's something, it's best to have the bad conversation on the first session. So I always tell them on the first session, even with the best rehab, you're going to have one flare-up at least. That's a part of the recovery. You know, it's getting the flare-up is part of the recovery. It's not a setback. It's just your body adapting it to it. And sometimes it's an external trigger. Sometimes it's a change in temperature. Sometimes it's stress factors. You're not sleeping for two weeks at stress at work. Sometimes we can't really know what triggers flare-ups. But as long as we make them realize that it's normal and you have a plan, people will accept that, you know. So we have to normalize flare-ups. And the second thing is we need to give them a plan. Otherwise, people will worry and they'll end up calling you, you know, keep sending you emails and, you know, take unnecessary injections and things like that. So initially, if you give them a plan, more likely they'll like to follow that.
I love it. Thank you. My second question is that when we are doing the subjective examination, do you feel we tend to miss out on getting information on what the patient actually can do despite the symptoms? So to be able to give the patient information on what he can do to stay active, I'm probably mainly thinking about athletes with this question, because athletes, if they have pain and they can't do a cross, they just don't want to do a straight line running.
Yeah, so I think the key thing here is to encourage them activity. So a couple of things which you can do in the subjective to assist that, for example, I'm just going through three or four questions, is obviously start with the current sport and hobbies that they do regularly. And another thing is, are you currently active in your sport? So many times they stop everything before they come and see me. And another thing would be is, how much have you had to change and modify in your sport due to your symptoms? So that's the key question. So how much do they have to adapt? In some patients, they don't have to adapt because they get only symptoms the next day. They can do a normal game, but they only suffer the next day. So in some patients, they have to adapt. For example, somebody will say, I've had this recreational footballer who said, I used to play on the wing. Now I can't play in the wing anymore because it hurts. Now I change position. I'm more in the center back because I don't have to sprint. So you have to see what modification they have done to adapt with their symptoms as well. And the other thing is, how much do you think your hip and groin pain affects your current level of competition in your sport? Do you think it's affecting your competitive level? Is it affecting performance? And this is a key factor, is because a lot of professional athletes and semi-professional athletes whom I see me, they accept hip and groin pain as normal. It's only when it starts affecting their performance and the recovery on the next day or something like that, they seek help. So if they feel like they can't sprint, they can't cut, and they can't kick, then they seek help. Or the delayed reaction is getting worse and worse. So initially, a common answer would be is, 2 years ago when I played, it was a bit sore for 2 days, so 2 hours or 1 hour, and it was fine. Now, if I play a game, it takes me 4 days to a week to recover. I'm hobbling for 2 days. So another difference is they can play a normal game, but they suffer longer. So that are the two questions. One, it affects their performance, which is why they seek help, the speed, the kicking, the change of direction. Number two, the recovery is much longer. So these are the two reasons. Pain is very rarely the reason they come usually, because they're used to, athletes are used to pain. If you're a CrossFitter, if you're a runner, if you're dealing high-level sports, that pain is part and parcel of your training. It's only when you affect your performance and your, next day symptoms, or it's affecting their ADLs. For example, they say, I can't drive anymore, I can play, but then I can't drive for 2 days. I can't sit, I can't have sex with my partner. So it's when those things happen, that's when they seek, So that's one of the reasons they come too late in many cases, because they wait till it affects their daily life or the performance. So it's knowing the current level of competition and also knowing how it is affecting their recovery and things like that.
Thank you so much for great answers, Benoit. And I hope I'll get the chance to meet up and see you in Iceland in November.
Yeah, good. Get me a Viking beer. Hmm?
Yes, I'll do. No worries.
Yeah.
Thank you, and I'll hand over to Dan, who has some questions for you from Australia. Thank you.
Hi, Benoit. My name is Dan. Also, as I just mentioned and previously as well, I'm from Australia. First of all, thank you for all your information you've given us here. It's very insightful. I think one thing that I've really realized is you pay a lot of attention to a lot of detail, which is obviously very important. My question is, moving forward, what can practitioners do to have a more successful subjective assessment? So you've already mentioned checklists, pre-screenings, having a bit of information before. Is there anything else, a way that you think that we can make these more successful?
Yeah, I think the first thing is, you know, you need to have the time. You know, there's some, sadly, because of financial constraints and other things, is these sort of patients, you don't want to rush them. So I think the minimum you need is 1 hour. You know, ideally 90 minutes is, you can do a good job with 1 hour. And in that 1 hour, in the first session, it's 45 minutes listening. It's only 10 minutes of the other test. Sometimes I don't even get the special test or the examination. So, you know, that's the big difference in my career. You know, 10 years back, maybe I did subjective 10 minutes and it was, 50 minutes of hands-on. Now it's the other way around. So first thing is giving the time. If you rush them, so that's the reason I never see my first patient for 30 minutes in private sector, because in NHS sometimes I have to do that. But in an ideal environment, when they see you, you want to give them the time. Second thing is, as I mentioned, is preparation on like pre-screening, giving them the tools before. Patients hate when you know nothing about them when they come and see you. You must take the time to, I always look up before they come and look at the history, simple things like, if they're working, make some comments on the personal comments as well. So there's nothing like taking that few minutes to prepare about their, history, and then, quote them and say, okay, you work for this bank, how is that going? Or you're doing triathlon, what's your PB on your 10K? So something like that. You need to, unless you spend that 2-3 minutes before they walk in your room, they can know that you've not done any preparation. It's like doing a public speaking. You always prepare. So same thing with the patients is, you don't need a lot of time, but at least 2 minutes or 3 minutes before looking at the forms, taking the time and just looking at the personal remarks will create you that sort of instant connection as well. And the environment is usually important, having that professional setup, and people like to know. One of the things people like to know is, have you treated this sort of cases before? So I always try to emphasize that, like, this is a common problem and I've seen people like you before. People always like that validation. Even now, after 20 years, I still say that with every patient. I say, for example, FAI patient, I say it's very common. I treat this quite commonly and it's, most people are successful. So you want to validate that and say to them, like, it's a common, everybody, even if you're the strongest person in the world, you like to be reassured and be told that it's normal, that it's something which happens to most people. Because when we have a problem, we like to think it's unique and it's something which only happens to me. So as long as you tell them, like, okay, for example, and also another key point here would be is, using examples like from, suppose you come from a sporting field, like a semi-professional footballer. So I'll give example. For example, hip scope. I'll say, see, let's look at people like Daniel Sturridge. Let's look at people like Eric, Lamela from Spurs. They ordered hip scopes. They went back to full level of, function. They're still playing. So people like to know those real world examples. There's no point quoting literature to patients. They want to know real world patients. So it's knowing those sort of star celebrities or other people who had these conditions. So, and they're still back playing. So it's just, so those sort of people had hip scopes and they're back playing at a decent level. Another fact would be is showing clips of previous people who have been successful with you. So I've got a good clip of a 41-year-old female physio who did a hip replacement with me, and she can squat full range of motion within 2 weeks. So it's always showing the success stories, showing them like, see, this patient can do well, and if they can do, so can you. So it's sort of those sort of tricks, so preparation, screening, giving them real, real world reference point, both in the celebrity world or people they can relate to, and also taking the time. So it's being, part listener, part coach, and part counselor. So it's not an easy, it's not something which I was not taught both in undergraduate or in postgraduate skills. It's something you pick up by watching other. The way I pick this up is to sit with other clinicians. So one of the things I do every 2 months or 3 months is I go and sit in other people's clinics. I'll sit with a rheumatologist. I'll sit with an orthopedic surgeon. I'll sit with a sports, medicine specialist. It's not that I want to know more clinically, which is always useful, but I'm more interested in the style of questioning and the way they address people. So I'm always fascinated in the art of the dialogue and the conversation. And that you can't, it's a lifelong learning. So the more you spend time with, and sometimes therapists, we can be in a bubble. We only see other physios. We only see other sports doctors, or we only see that. So for me, you know, I can get some help from everyone. So sometimes I sit with the rheumatologist, you know, or you know, endocrinologist, or anyone, because I'm not interested in the clinical element. I'm more interested in their communication skills. So this is something we can do, learn from each other, is to sit with different clinicians, see what are the questions they use and how they improve compliance. So this, I think, are some useful tools to improve your subjective skills, in my opinion.
Thank you very much. I mean, you just keep on providing more and more really like useful. And I guess, like you said, we get caught in a bubble. So thinking outside that square and broadening our perspective and communications really important.
Moving I think on. One tip would be useful here is, so think about your hip and groin patient and think about their journey. So think of all the people they're going to see on the journey. So they're going to see a GP, they're going to see a sports doc, they're going to see an orthopedic surgeon, they're going to see a SNC coach, they're going to see a sports therapist. So it's really important to understand the outcome and the outlook from each of those people. So for me, I know exactly what my strength and conditioning physio will, you know, coach will ask. I know exactly what my my orthopedic surgeon will ask. So you can only know that if you sat with them. You know, you can't make that assumption. So it's really important taking the time and meeting all the fellow professionals and see how the journey of the patient goes through. Because the last thing you want to do is give conflicting information. You say something, then the surgeon says something, then, you know, the SNC coach says something, then you get this sort of, disagreement. We can't be doing that. So we should all be, you know, saying a similar message. So unless we know what other guys are saying, we could be in trouble. So that's really important when you're working in the teams, that you sort of shadow each other and see, you know, what are the exact language. And because people pick this up very early, because they'll say, you said this, but the surgeon, the consultant said something else, you know, and that can create conflict and lead to problems. So it's really important that we have a common agenda and sort of a common message, especially in a clinical environment, so that it leads to clear transparency. And it's like having a similar message, so that we are reinforcing the same thing and there's no conflict. So many things, you know, people quote me is, once they've done the subjective, they're surprised and say, oh, you know, what you said is exactly what my surgeon said. It's not a surprise because I sat with the surgeon, so I've just quoted exactly similar. So it's anything which is good is not a surprise. It's always prepared. So there's no randomness in that. So if you prepare well and if you have a similar script, what the consultant says, what the physio says, patients like that. They like that uniformity. They like that uniformity because they like to know that everybody is saying the same thing. So that's a really key point, is keeping that sort of consistency in the message we tell our patients. So one patient can't say, like, you know, the surgeon will say, oh, you can start running in 2 months. But then, you know, it's not going to happen 2 months after hip scope. So it's a very difficult conversation. So when you work with consultants and other things, you should make it very clear that you're saying a similar message, you know. If you say, you know, if the physio says you can run in 4 or 5 months, but the surgeon says he can run in 2 months, that creates a problem. So we should have consistent timelines on the message. We can't give exact dates, but we should be saying, okay, normal running after a hip scope takes so much time. You know, for example, we know from the literature, you know, adductor rehab, return to sport takes 12 to 16 weeks. There's no shortcuts there. And, you know, pubic-related groin pain, osteitis pubis can even take 3 months to 1 year. You know, it's not something you can jump straight away. So those sort of timelines, you know, take time. And the worst thing you can do is somebody tell you, you can go back playing in 2 weeks' time. It doesn't happen in some cases. So if you're consistent with the message and with the timelines, then patients are more likely to believe the team, and that will be best for everyone.
Beautiful. Thank you for that, Johnny.
Fantastic. Wow. Okay. You speak so fast as well, Benoit. It's been...
You can always slow it down with your software.
Nah, it's great. It's great. Listen, I'm going to wrap it up then with a question. And so you've done all your questions. You've ruled out you've got a high suspicion for red flags. You've looked at location. We've looked at pain. We've looked at the demographic coming in there. We've addressed the person as well as their complaint. We've even talked about why. We've looked at open-ended questions and then a funnel approach for that. So we've done all that. We've taken our time with the patient on the first one. So when you give them the diagnosis, and can you get a diagnosis from a subjective? Do you have to do a physical examination?
Yeah, I think the key thing is the danger you want to do is give. It's very hard, especially with hip and groin. And I've done that mistake a few times. I said to a patient, he's got impingement, and then an X-ray came with a dysplasia. So I never make that mistake again. So what I do is, sometimes it can even take 3-4 sessions to get to know what is happening, on that. So what people want is honesty. So what I'll do is, I say to them on session one is, there's a lot of information from what you've given me. It's likely that the symptoms are more from the hip. I don't say diagnosis like impingement or dysplasia or erector. So I'll say one thing which we can say with some confidence is it's most likely within the hip or outside the hip. So I can say, I think from what you're saying, from all the tests I've done, from all the questions, is most likely the symptoms from the hip or from the muscles outside. So I keep it very generic, like intra-articular or extra-articular or referred pain. And I think it's reasonable you can say that and say, like, it's a hip problem, it's a muscle problem, or it's coming from other areas. And then we say, we keep always the diagnosis open. And if things change, we don't have to rush to imaging straight away on session one. But if your symptoms are not, it's not consistent and, things are getting worse, or you have a bit of confusion on, your rehab is not working, then I think you need. The only time I would rush to an imaging if I suspect a red flag. Most of the time, people don't need an imaging on the because it's a clinical diagnosis, and experienced clinicians can know whether it's intra-articular or extra-articular. I think, you should be able to pick up an adductor-related groin pain. So one of the things which is really useful here for a junior clinician is to use the Doha consensus. So we can say it's hip-related groin pain, it's adductor-related. I don't use the word tendinopathy, tears, bursitis and things like that. It's impossible unless you have a scan to tell whether it's a tear or a tendinopathy. So I keep it very, like the Doha consensus, I keep it, it's adductor-related groin pain, it's hip-related groin pain, it's pubic-related groin pain, it's hip flexor-related groin pain. I think you can say that within a session or two. But to give specific diagnosis like hip impingement, or adductor avulsion tear or things like that, that will need imaging and it might not be necessary or appropriate on session one. So, but we can give them general categories. On the other extreme, we don't want to be saying like you've got like non-specific hip pain. You can't be too vague as well. People don't like that, especially when you're working in the city. You can't be too wishy-washy and give them very vague diagnosis like muscle imbalance. They want to know roughly what it is about. And people can accept diagnosis like hip-related groin pain or adductor-related groin pain, which I think is a nice halfway house between being too specific or being too vague.
Yeah, I guess coming from, and firstly, keeping the diagnosis open is a really good strategy for the clinician and the patient. So if you can get the patient to buy into that, then I find that very helpful. And it changes a little bit. So there's when you're dealing with professional athletes, because they've got less tolerance for an open diagnosis. So yeah. They're, and because there are other confounding factors, so there's, coaching staff involved, there'll be stakeholders involved and so on and so forth. So, as in we do a lot of industrial scanning, and I say to the athletes as well, look, I wouldn't hang my hat on a diagnosis. It's more a case of what we're going to do to get you back there, Yeah. So, and they'll want the diagnosis. They'll also
and I think, can I interrupt, but I think there's a really relevant point here. One of the things we can try to diffuse the diagnosis is, we know from the literature, for example, like, if you look at the normal morphology, like FAA, so one of the common numbers I give to my patients just to diffuse the situation is, for example, I'll say, if you look at the normal population, 1 in 4 will have a hip impingement morphology. And if you go to a sporting, club like Chelsea, Arsenal, or anyone, at least 3 in 4 will have a hip impingement morphology. The more fitter and more active you are, you're more likely to 70 to 90% of high-level athletes will have a hip morphology which is consistent with impingement. And if you go for dancers, it'll be dysplastic. And another fact people get obsessed about is a labral tear. So a good, systematic review from Josh Sherry from Australia says 1 in 2 people without hip pain have a labral tear on imaging. So if 1 in 2 people without pain have labral tear, so it's extremely common diagnosis. So sometimes using statistics like this is useful to diffuse this sort of tension they have. Is first is to demedicalize hip impingement, say that it's a normal morphology. It's like having a bit of scoliosis or flat foot or genu varum. It's a normal variation of the human body. It's not a pathology. And the second thing is the labral tear is not a diagnosis. It's something which we see on MRIs, something which happens as you get old. So if you try to demedicalize it and try to make it as a normal variation of the human body, because people will walk in with a scan and say, I got a labral tear. I got Cam Benjamin. But you have to make them understand that it's very common. 1 in 4 of us have it, and 3 in 4 of sporting happen. And then it becomes common, and they become a little bit more chilled with the answer. So sometimes this sort of statistics can be useful.
I think we've lost Johnny Wilson.
Yeah. Wow.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, there you are. There you. I thought you did the runner, mate. I thought you were trying a different suit on, or maybe a dress or something. All right.
No, I was just saying that we have a young footballer, a second year scholar, and he's a professional. He's hoping to win a professional contract, and he is desperate for a diagnosis.
Yes.
He's recently just got injured. And it's the adventures of the great Francis McGroin. This is the player.
Yeah.
And and he's working with Pepper Watson now. So he's Pepper has got to, she's got to put together her subjective. So she's just had a chat with you on this podcast, and the next chapter will be coming out very, very soon. So you never know, Benoit, you might get a mention in the subjective chapter, which is coming out over the next few days.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, that's good.
Now, and I'm going to put you on the spot before I get you to do an outro, and that is, Francie has just gone through his subjective examination, which you'll be able to read about over the next few days.
Yeah.
And we were hoping to send him to the great Benoit Matthews for a physical examination, and would you take up the challenge of writing the chapter on the physical examination for the great Francie McGroin when the great Francie McGroin meets the great Benoit Matthews?
This putting me under the spotlight, but as I said, if you send me information, then I'll be definitely interested, because I'm in the way of doing two book chapters, writing up a few things, and you had a book published, and you know how hard it is when you come with that.
It was easy, Benoit. It was easy. Stop bluffing. Two chapters. I had to write 50. Don't worry about it. You'll be fine. I can't wait to see it. It's 1,200 words of fascinating content from the great Benoit Matthews. You heard it on here, guys. He had a great podcast. Let's hope you don't let yourself down right at the end, Benoit. Yeah, there was only one answer. We're going live.
Okay. Yes, definitely. Yeah. So, Johnny, anything for you?
My good friend Benoit, I'm going to hand you over to our host of ceremony, Stel, and he will ask where people can get in touch with you. But I thought it was fantastic, fascinating podcast. Really loved it. For all those people out there, make sure you check it out. Stelios.
Benoit, thanks for joining us, mate. Really appreciate it. I mean, I actually felt like I was in a seminar or something. Honestly. That was a compliment, by the way. I'm just saying.
Right, Stel. Stel, are you going to give us an outro for that? Are you going to ask Benoit, where can people find
you? I was getting there. I was just paying him a compliment.
Yes, a lot of things I'm acting on. So the first is Twitter. So I'm, always more check every day at Function to Fitness. Obviously, I can share the links if you could share on the show notes. I'm on LinkedIn, Instagram, all the normal channels. So one of the things I want to put a plug is, we're big fans of a lot of high quality free CPD. We did a free series on Function to Fitness. Now we're launching a big master athlete symposium. So it's masterathletes.online. I'll give you the link to Johnny, so it'd be great if you could share that. So we're getting 15 world-class speakers, Rich Wiley, Escolier, so all the top guys. So it's a bit depressing. Apparently, if you're 35 plus, you become a master athlete. I thought it was 40, 45 plus, but you start aging after 35, apparently quite quickly in endurance sports. So that is, we're going to look into all the common pathologies from running, triathlon. So you're going to get a lot of free content. There are about 24 videos, and you've got free access for them on the day on the 8th of August. So it would be great if you could spread the word and join us on the 8th of August on the Master Athlete Symposium.
Sounds awesome.
Great stuff. Well, that's it for another episode of 108 Harley Street. We'll be back same time next month, hopefully. So until next time, take care.